This week on the Best of Flashpoints, American Indian Movement founder Clyde Bellecourt joins us from the RNC. Tragic death tolls across the Caribbean, especially in Haiti. Malik Rahim joins us from Common Ground Relief in New Orleans. Community business with Catherine Austin Fitz. And the Block Report on the recent violent arrest of a nonviolent African-American KPFA radio producer. The cops called inside the station by none other than KPFA management. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue to broadcast excerpts of our coverage from the Republican National Convention in St. Paul last week from the Native American perspective. First up, we hear from American Indian Movement founder Clyde Bellecourt responding to the Republican perspective on the environment and other relevant issues.
Well, you know, they've been after the oil up there for many, many years in Alaska, and I'm sure that that's why he selected her. You know, the Native people have billions of barrels of oil underneath them, and I'm sure they'll find ways to remove the Indian people and take control of their resources. They have done this all over the continental United States.
We've been broadcasting from the Indigenous School here in St. Paul, and we've been watching out the window and in the streets as dozens and scores and hundreds of all kinds of police and Homeland Security make raids, arrest people in the street. What's your response to this kind of police state here in St. Paul, the founding place and the home of the modern American Indian movement?
Well, you know, that's the very first thing that we did when we formed in July of 1968. We knew that we had to show the Native people here, the Indian people here, the Twin City area and across this country, that we meant business, that we were not fly-by-night organization that would come and go. So to prove that to them, the first thing we did was formulate an American Indian Movement patrol, radio-equipped our cars and invited people to join us. Did a lot of training, a lot of stuff with first aid, emergency response teams and et cetera, cameras, tape recorders. And out of that, of course, we formed the Legal Rights Center. I'm one of the founders. In fact, me and my wife are the only remaining founders of the Legal Rights Center here in Minneapolis. We have 6 attorneys and 7 community workers, investigators that work for us. And we've actually handled our 76,000 case. We started monitoring the police brutality, the racism, a lot of the ignorance that brings on racism in our community, restaurants, cafes, bars. And you name it, hospitals, we started hitting all of them. We started watching, photographing everything that happened. And we started having Red Ribbon Grand Jury hearings where we'd call on the police chief to show up. And if he didn't show up, we'd drape his chair with a black cloth and put his name on and invite all the media there and go ahead with our testimony. We finally brought those kinds of people to the table, the mayor and the chief of police. And out of the publicity and the embarrassment, they started to show up. And we started to see a tremendous change takes place. Today, I'm the co-chair of the Police Community Relations Council, which was mandated by the United States federal government 5 years ago over the police profiling of blacks, Native American, gays, lesbian, and transsexual community. And when we got through investigating the police department, we found out that they were in violation of 146 different parts of their own code of conduct. And so this is nothing new what's happening here in St. Paul in the fenced-off areas that they're making to hold people and detain people and make their charges against them. And the brutality that is happening right now here in the streets of St. Paul is not new to Indian people. Let's not forget, you know, that since Columbus landed here in this part of the world, there's been 120 million Indian people erased from the face of the earth. Whole tribes totally decimated. But today, we fight back, and we do everything that is necessary to expose that type of behavior. Only when you're able to expose it are you able to get the type of public support needed to make change. So we're not surprised at all what's taking place on the streets here in St. Paul during the Republican gathering that's taking place here in the Twin City area.
Some people refer to this as a criminal injustice system because poor people and people of color, indigenous people, can't hope to get a fair shot. What's your response? And do we live in a criminal injustice system?
Well, yeah, we as Native people, of course, have lived that way since the first boat landed here. You know, I testified today that my father joined the United States Marine Corps when he was just a mere lad, just turned 16 years old at Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. And it wasn't until 6 years later, after he came home with 17 machine gun wounds, gassed and bloated and totally disabled, that the United States government felt fit to pass the Indian Citizenship Act, which granted us citizenship here in our own country, you know. So the only thing, the thing that we found out is we have to organize, we have to join, we have can't be isolated as Native people. We have to join a massive coalition like what has taken place here today in the march that took place, that we have to act together, we have to work together. And one thing for sure, you know, we are the victim, and people just have to look at our history. And, you know, when they talk about the occupation of Iraq, well, our land here has been occupied now for over 500 years, you know. They celebrate the 150th anniversary here in the state of Minnesota, and I had to remind them that they started the scalping policy right here. Indian people didn't know nothing about scalping. I had to remind them of the 38 Dakota that were hung, innocent people. None of them spent more than 5 minutes in a courtroom, like an assembly line. And when they got through, they had already sentenced over 340-some people to death. They were going to hang them on November 4th, but unfortunately they didn't have enough rope. They had to requisition the rope from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And while that requisition was going through, when they went down to get enough rope to hang him in a massive hanging, a guy by the name of Bishop Whipple, Episcopal minister, went and saw then-President Abraham Lincoln to plead the cases of these people. And they trimmed it all the way down to 38. And finally, Abraham Lincoln told him, we can't go any further. They're getting teletypes and the congressional delegation, the pressure was on the newspaper and everything that they had to they had to pay for the war of 1862, and so they hung 38 Dakota people, and the ones that were freed were never freed. They put them, they brought them into to a place called Fort Snelling out here in the dead cold winter, coldest day of the year. They marched them through all these little Christian towns. People stood on the rooftops and poured oil on them and poured cold water on him. And one place, a little Christian town called St. Peter, a woman ran out and grabbed a baby right by the ankles and smashed its head, an Indian baby, its head against the wall and killed her. And she was never charged because there was no law against killing an Indian. In fact, there was a bounty on Indian people here for $80 for a female, and I mean for a male, and $60 for a female, and $25 for a child. And so wholesale slaughter was taking place here in the state of Minnesota. When they got ready to celebrate their 150th anniversary, which was back in May 11 and 12, I was standing in front of these Capitol steps and standing in front of the governor, Pawlenty, let him know that he was plenty of nothing, because he didn't mention nothing, absolutely nothing, what happened to Indian people. So they try to hide that history, and we don't allow them. We don't allow them to do that.
Well, speaking of the Republican governor, the Republicans have chosen as their key interest, as we see one more hurricane hitting the South, that the Republicans say that their theme of the convention is the environment. Have any response to the Republicans and the environment?
Well, I mean, you know, everybody can see what's happening all over the world, not only here in the United States, but all over the world. There's already another hurricane formulated out in the ocean right now. It's much, much bigger than the one that just came in and missed New Orleans, just barely missed New Orleans and turned into a Category 2. Now they're hitting the saying it's a Category 1, and everybody's kind of cheering and feeling good about it. The president now feels that he's freed up and he can come here to St. Paul at least by Thursday. Wednesday or Thursday, he plans on being there. Presidential candidate John McCain and the president of the United States, you know. So they're blind. They cannot see what is happening to the environment. They can't see all the bees that are dying. They can't see the trees dying from the top down. A medicine man told us here 34 years ago, he came through town, that we'd be paying more for a gallon of gasoline than we would for a pint of water. And we only had what was called Glenwood Springs here at the time. And now we got over 100 different kinds of water being flown in from all over the world. So, you know, It doesn't take a blind man could see what was happening here. But, of course, the Republican, they don't really care, you know. I have a brother of mine, a spiritual leader, and he said, and they're racing to get to find life on another planet. He says, I hope they find it. You know, I hope they find it, and I hope there's a lot of gold there, because then we know where they're going, and maybe Mother Earth will purify and take care of herself and survive.
If you had 5 minutes with Bush, if they gave you 5 minutes, would you take it? And if you had 5 minutes, what would you tell him?
Well, it wouldn't make any difference what you told him. The guy is so dumb and so stupid, he'd probably forget everything you said 2 minutes after you talked to him. I'm kind of waiting, and if Obama gets in, I'm still going to kind of wait and see what he really does, if he really means. He said he's going to put somebody into a cabinet-level, a policymaker in a cabinet-level position. But he's the only candidate that's ever said that in his history, that he's going to elevate an Indian person to the cabinet level, because we are separate nations. We're sovereign nations, and he wants to have develop that relationship with us. Believe it or not, you know, it doesn't make no difference to us whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. They've all stolen from us. We didn't get this land for nothing, you know. Our great chiefs put in stuff in there, the right to hunt, to fish, to gather, to practice our own traditional way of life, to educate our children. And they wrote sentence in there like this: this land, the government did, we, our chiefs did, this land and this way of life that we reserve for ourselves will be ours as long as the grass grows green, the rivers flow, and the sun shines. But to the white man that they made the treaties with, the United States government said, this land will be yours as long as the grass grows green, the rivers flow, and the sun shines, or until we find some gold, or we find some oil, or we find some uranium, or we find water, or we find rich farmland that we need, we find timber that is needed. That's when the sun quits shining, the rivers quit flowing, the grass quits growing green. I never met an Indian Republican yet.
Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
In humanity's name, at the altars of life, in the temples of greed, the manufacturers of war, God wars to believe in a blending of they into we, using religion to justify killing, hiding behind God, implying it's God who's on a killing spree.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Burns, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. After evacuating over 1 million people from New Orleans, most are back in their houses facing the same difficult conditions and the possibility of another hurricane. With the presidential campaign in full swing, there seems to be little attention given to the potential disaster from one of the oncoming storms. In Haiti, more than 1,000 people have died after 3 major hurricanes ravaged the Caribbean. Over 4 years ago, we reported over 2,000 deaths from Hurricane Jean. Since that time, despite more than $4 billion in so-called aid to Haiti, nothing was done to prepare for this onslaught. Joining us to talk about the current situation in Haiti is our special correspondent, Kevin Pina. And from New Orleans is our good friend Malik Rahim of Common Ground Relief. I thank both of you for joining us on Flashpoints. Let me come to you first, Kevin. Give us the overview. How bad is it in Haiti?
Well, now what we have is a situation where there are reports of over 1,000 who have died so far. Actually, the Haitian government is in no position, neither is the United Nations, to tell us exactly how many victims there actually have been. There are entire swaths of the country, north of the capital and in the south, toward Jérémy, that are now completely cut off. We know that more than 1 million people are homeless. There are tremendous threats of waterborne and airborne diseases because of carcasses that, of course, have been washed away. Really, you have a devastation and disaster of epical proportions in Haiti, largely because of lack of preparation and infrastructure.
And of course, the country is particularly vulnerable because of the environmental destruction, the soil, the cutting down of the trees because they were needed for heat and cooking. So there are very special conditions as well.
Well, but there are also conditions that could have easily been prepared for, levees on rivers that they know were bound to flood. You know that Go Naive has no stock of basic good, meaning medicines, drinking water, and basic equipment, rescue equipment. None of that was stockpiled, despite 4 years ago our having reported the devastation over, as you said, over 2,000 people having died in Hurricane Jean. And of course, there's been more than $4 billion in economic aid, and a lot of U.S. taxpayer dollars, quite frankly, pumped into Haiti since then. If people go to the web and they do a quick web search, Hurricane Jean, J-E-N-N-E, and Haiti, you will see all of the promises that were made by the United Nations, all of the so-called grandiose plans that were part of their project to rebuild the government after the ousting of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February 2004. None of it was realized. There was no evacuation of Go Naive.
Where did the money go?
That's a good question. That's a question that most mainstream reporters will not ask, do not ask, but it's certainly the number one question that I have on my mind. Where did the money go?
Do you expect the death toll to climb?
Absolutely. I think this will surpass 2,000. As I said, entire swaths of the country are completely out of the picture right now. They are not even in communication with the central government. And remember, when we're talking about the death toll right now, we're talking about cities like Go Naive, major cities. There are large swaths in the countryside where there has not even been an accounting of how many people have died.
It's amazing because in Cuba, four people or five people died. In Haiti, it's more than 1,000 already, and it's probably going to get a lot higher.
Well, and Hurricane Ike hit Havana with full force. Over 1 million people in that capital city. And despite being cash-strapped, despite being economically isolated all of these years, the Cuban people only had four victims from Hurricane Ike.
All right, now stand by, Kevin. Let's go to New Orleans, where we're joined by Malik Rahim of Common Ground Relief. Malik, there's about, I guess, over 1 million people who were recently evacuated from New Orleans. I guess a lot have come back. Why don't you set the scene? You hear what's going on in Haiti. Give us a perspective from New Orleans.
Well, right now, you know, people is coming back. They are strapped for cash because they are broke. People spent all, who had anything, spent it on the highways trying to get away. I mean, it was one of the saddest things that you could witness when you see people being told that the mother of all storms is about to hit the city, and they don't have nothing. And they're trying to drive out with the few possessions that they was able to obtain in the aftermath of Katrina, and they was trying to take them out with $10-$15 a gas. I mean, that's all you're seeing is a string of cars, you know, on the highways that had ran out of gas. And then you're seeing how some individuals just took advantage of it. I know we had a truck to break down on us, and it was only towed 5 miles. So we have charged $550 for that towing. And it's happening to so many people. We are not a funded organization, but we have to buy gas cars to give to people who come back. Because with many of them, they ain't had nothing to come back with. We are blessed that Ike isn't coming into this direction. So many people has already said that they can't take it no more. What we are going through, I guess, is no proportion. Because there's a saying that I once complained that I had no shoes until I met a man who had no feet. And that's the way it is between what we are going through and what's going through in Haiti. It's overwhelming because that's a sister city to New Orleans. We were both colonized by the French. Just maybe if they wouldn't have been under almost 200 years of sanctions from America. You know, that this wouldn't happen, because it shouldn't be. The distinction between those two nations on that island is as clear as one got trees and one don't. You know, and it just wasn't for no firewood. It's things that we have to do as a people to show the type of solidarity that is needed to make sure that we can once again become a great nation. You know, I mean, we have to reach out. What's happening in Haiti, yes, it's an injustice, but all of us are guilty of it. All of us have an obligation to it, to make sure that those people who suffer, their needs are met in a humane way. You know, but if we can't do it at home, I know we can't do it abroad.
Let me jump in here for a moment, Malik Rahim. Obviously, it's very important and good to have you on the show. I'm just back from the martial law city of St. Paul and the Republican Convention, where there was to be a great deal of sensitivity to the suffering that people would be facing from these hurricanes. McCain went to Mississippi. Do you feel that the presidential candidates understand the pain you're describing, Malik?
I don't believe neither one of them understand it. Neither one of them have a clue. You know, because if they would, they would be down here. You know, it wouldn't be no more, and nothing would be more important than coming down here and restoring hope. I mean, it's not just in Louisiana, because we was graciously taken in the city of Hattiesburg. You know, I mean, that really showed the type of humanitarian love that should be shown to those fleeing any type of disaster. We was greeted with it there. But while I was there, I found out about the struggle that is going on in Mississippi. Unemployment, AIDS, lack of health care. We went into a couple of towns where the closest health clinic was something like about 80 miles. You know, I mean, and that's here. I'm not talking about in Haiti. I'm talking about right here in America. It's easy to say anything. But, you know, but people need to see you. They need to see the type of leadership that you want to have. They need to see that if something would happen that's impacting this many people and this much of a reason, that you will come down and listen to them. If you want to call it politicking, that could be done. You know, but it's not just them, all candidates. Not just the major, all of them. Like I said once before on your show, all of them need to be down here. If the majors don't come, then the others need to be here to make sure that they can shame them into doing what they should be done. Because I'll never forget when my father told me that Johnson, he didn't send no press release. He came down to New Orleans. He came into the Ninth Ward. You know, I mean, you ought to see some of these levees. See if what this city would have been able to do if Ike would have hit us. And if no other reason, I mean, look at what we are trying to do now in Dulac and Punisher and in Homer. I mean, the way people are suffering. You know, I mean, and that's without nothing, because I'm going to tell you, it seems like we just stop understanding the blessings that we have, because we sure don't want to share them in the degree that they need to be shared. It would be nothing for us to not only help the people here, but also help the people of Haiti, you know, and of Cuba. You know, I mean, we should be there. Those who say that we are progressive. Those who say that we really stand for peace and justice, this is the time to act. This is the time to show the rest of the world that in America there are still people that stand for peace and justice, that we're just not a nation of oppressors and exploiters.
That's the voice of Malik Rahim speaking to us from the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. Let me take the conversation here. I want to come back to you, Kevin Pina, our correspondent for Haiti. What needs to happen, Kevin?
Well, first of all, we got to remember that largely what's going on in Haiti is because the United States government led a coup against a democratically elected government on that island. That country has still not recovered from that blow. That's one of the reasons they can pour $4 billion into Haiti and they cannot evacuate a town like Gonaiva of 160,000 people. After 4 years of intervention by the United States, of pouring more than $4 billion, a large part of it U.S. taxpayer dollars into that country, we can say that very little has been done. And I think that the results of these last three hurricanes show that so, so clearly to everyone, anyone who will look at it with an objective eye. And again, I just want to state that what you're seeing in Haiti today is evidence that that country has still not recovered and has a long way to recovering from that intervention that was foisted upon the Haitian people, that was brutalized the Haitian people, brought by the Bush administration, by the government of Chirac in France, and by the government of Paul Martin in Canada. Today, the Haitian people are still suffering because of it.
And Malik Rahim, major changes. What could be done now? What needs to happen if anything is going to change?
First thing, we need to go back into the base. We need to get out there and restore our wetland. That should be our number one priority. How can we restore some of this 8,000 square miles that we have lost of wetland? Second, our emphasis should be on how can we start restoring lives. Listen, we spend more money in New Orleans. We spent enough this year in New Orleans on incarcerating nonviolent offenders than it would take to rebuild the Night Ward, the lower Night Ward. You know, I mean, look what Brad Pitt have done with just one organization. He have done more than anyone else have done in the Night Ward. And that's just one individual. So what would happen if we was truly working toward making sure that those things that is needed is being offered? Because right now, and this is 3 years after the hurricane that hit the Ninth Ward, there's less than 200 homes that have been rebuilt in the section between Jordan and the Parish Line and Claiborne and Florida Avenue. It's still, an area that had almost over 2,000 homes. So it's still less than 10% have been restored. And God knows what it would be like right now if it wasn't for Brad Pitt.
And if you take another broadside, if you get hit again, what happens?
I'm going to tell you, if we get hit again, almost, I hate to say it, I believe almost half of the African-American community in New Orleans going to give up on this city.
All right, Malik, want to thank you for joining us. We're going to keep in close touch, as we always do, with you and the people working with you at Common Ground Relief, who are telling a story that has simply been cleansed from the mainstream. We heard so much in the way of rhetoric from the Republicans and the Democrats about their sympathies for the people of New Orleans. We appreciate the information. How can people learn more and get involved if they'd like?
They can go on our website, commongroundrelief.org. Or they can call us at area code 504-304-9097.
All right.
I'm going to tell you, it's always an honor, Dennis. It's always an honor to be on your show.
All right. Malik Rahim, thanks for being with us from New Orleans.
It's extraordinary. However, Haiti is, you know, you got to remember that people in Haiti were starving. Remember with the April food riots, Haiti hasn't had a government except 2 weeks ago. This country is in a shambles since this project to overthrow Aristide in February 2004. Their local production of foodstuff has already been destroyed, making them dependent upon imports of large agro manufacturers in the United States. At the same time, not being able to get out from under the yoke of basically what is a political elite, an economic elite in Haiti, 1% of the country that controls over 50% of the collective wealth in that nation. And so you add not only to the starvation, these three hurricanes, and you have a country which is now the self-fulfilling prophecy of the Bush administration and the international community, a de facto failed state in Haiti today.
It's horrible. All right, Kevin Pina, thanks for the information. As troubling as it is, it's important for us to know exactly what the real politics are there. We thank you for being with us and for all the great work and the reporting that you've done for us. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Yesterday, on a sleepy Washington Sunday, the U.S. government made a surprise announcement that it would take over and bail out the troubled mortgage lenders Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The bailout is the largest in U.S. history. Between them, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae financed nearly half of the outstanding mortgages in the U.S. Both have already lost billions during the current housing crash and subprime meltdown. Joining us to talk about Fannie and Freddie failing is Catherine Austin Fitz. Fitz is a regular contributor to Flashpoints. Haven't heard her in a little bit. And we're glad to have her back for this special community business report. Welcome back, Catherine Austin.
Thanks, Fitz. Dennis. It's always good to be back.
I've been reading your marvelous treatise on the Economic Recovery Act of 2008 and what it has to do with housing. And I guess you predicted that this is exactly what would happen. Explain what a bailout means and what the initial impact is, besides the fact that Asian markets did well.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac securitized mortgages. So let's say you want to buy a house, your bank or your local mortgage banker helps you originate a mortgage, and then they take those mortgages, they put them in pools, and they sell them to Fannie and Freddie, who will then turn around and issue securities that are backed by those mortgages, okay? And Fannie and Freddie have 50% of the market, but as their market share this year in terms of how many mortgages they're doing are 70 to 80%. So these guys have a real monopoly along with the other governmental agencies for the mortgage market in this country. And what's been happening, Dennis, as you know, since the mid-90s, is we've been issuing more and more mortgages, and there's been more and more fraud within the mortgage system, creating unserviceable levels of debt. But now what happened last month is the Treasury got the authority to basically bail out Freddie and Fannie if they wanted. That was the Housing and Economic Recovery Act that passed, I guess it was July 23rd, and the president signed it in law on the 30th. And now what you're seeing is the Treasury and the Federal Reserve Act to do that. And what they're doing in the process is that there are three layers of securities that represent Fannie and Freddie's ownership and financing. You've got stock, you've got preferred stock, and then you've got the bonds and mortgage-backed securities, and on top of all of that, you've got derivatives. Now, essentially, what the Treasury has done is move to protect the value of the bonds and to keep the derivative markets from having a huge sort of nuclear collision, and that comes at the cost of the shareholders and the preferred stockholders, who are, in effect, almost wiped out.
Now, how will this affect the debt?
Okay, what this does is essentially give a federal guarantee, and presumably what's happening behind the scenes is they're making sure that then the derivatives that are piled on top of those bonds are also protected. Now, what that does, if you go to the typical state pension fund, let's say they've lost $100 million on the stock, because the stock has gone from $68 to 68 cents in
well,
a year.
What stock?
The shares of ownership. Freddie and Fannie were private companies.
Yes.
So shareholders owned the stock, and a lot of the big shareholders were pension funds and the kind of mutual funds that I'm sure if your listeners look at their 401k and IRAs and they look into their equity funds, for example, a lot of the socially responsible investment funds had big positions in Fannie and Freddie.
And we're talking about pension funds of teachers and nurses and all our mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and children.
Right. Now, some people may not realize they have big investments in Freddie and Fannie because they've got a money market account or they've got a bond fund or they've got a stock fund, and they've never looked inside to see what's really there. So let's say you buy a socially responsible, you know, social index fund. It's going to have big positions in Freddie, Fannie, and many of the big banks.
Talk to us about what creditor politics is.
Fannie and Freddie point out that creditor politics is now a matter of national security. Approximately $1 trillion of Freddie and Fannie's $5 trillion of outstanding debt were owned essentially by central banks and sovereign governments around the world. Russia owned $100 billion of Freddie and Fannie. I'm presuming that that's bonds. And in fact, Dennis, the most recent report tonight was that they're down to $60 billion. So one of the problems has been worldwide, people are shedding. You know, they're shedding their positions.
What's the longer view here? Why is this happening? Where's the breakdown?
Longer view? The first thing, and I don't know how to describe it ideologically, but we now have the federal government owning and controlling the entire U.S. residential mortgage market. So if somebody said, well, you're now in a communist or fascist system, you know, as a matter of ideology, that's remarkably close. So, you know, I talked to somebody today who said, well, this is the end of all private property. Technically, that's not the case, but this is an extraordinary centralization of the economy. So that's number one. Number two, this could happen, Dennis, for two reasons, because I'm interested in where we have the power to act as opposed to, you know, what somebody else can do. If every one of us over the last 10 years had said, I'm only going to invest my money in things that are real and that don't do harm, you know, that are useful, because we knew the mortgage bubble was not sustainable, and we knew it was destroying communities. We knew it was doing a great deal of harm. So if everybody just said, look, I'm only going to put my money in something that's real, and it's not based on force, and it's not based on corruption, this could never have happened. That's number one. Number two, if you talk to most Americans over the last 5 years and ask them why they're invested in so much Fannie and Freddie, they say, well, I want something that's secure that gives me a good yield. Well, the reality is, you know, the government has now intervened to protect their bond yield, but the shareholders have been wiped out. The government's canceling $2 billion a year in remaining dividends. So the message is, it's first and foremost important to protect your assets before it is to just not think and go wherever you need to get yield. And if we had followed those two basic, you know, my mother was a Philadelphia Quaker, and we had these things beat into our heads when we were kids, you know, because everything you do need to know to understand investment, you learned in kindergarten. You know, don't steal, don't cheat, don't lie, you know, and don't put your money in things that don't make fundamental sense to you.
Catherine, I'm going to change the subject here and talk about the Republican National Convention. You know, I was in the streets of St. Paul and I watched the massive police presence and the terrible beatings of many young people. We had on testimony on Friday of a young man who claimed that he was tortured in police custody, and he was covered with bruises, and it looked like he was telling the truth. It was massive police power. We even saw in trains troops or National Guard. We checked out the rivers. We were traveling with a number of Native Americans who know the region very, very well. And there were Navy SEALs in the waters in this state that's proud of its reputation of the land of, I think, 10,000 lakes. Now, I was also looking at your blog. Uh-huh. And I noticed that there was an entry in your blog regarding the question was being asked, why did the city of St. Paul require an agreement with the RNC stipulating that the RNC would reimburse the city of St. Paul for any liabilities and damages stemming from lawsuits concerning the treatment of protesters, or he said, the writer says, or rather mistreatment of protesters and media, trampling civil liberties and constitutional rights. By the way, I talked to a lot of store owners in St. Paul, and they took an incredible hit. How does this relate to what we're talking about?
It's one and the same thing. When you have a highly centralized economy that is dependent on investors around the world holding this paper, your risk increases. And as your risk increases, you cannot afford to have dissension, and you cannot afford for anybody around the world. I mean, if the Russians are dumping Fannie and Freddie, so they've gone from $100 billion to $60 billion, that puts terrible pressure on the market, the kind of pressure that forces this kind of bailout. So you can't afford dissension. You can't afford for people to make the system look bad through the media. And part of it is your risk is going up, 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 and the system is much more fragile. And the reality, as we know, is the political consensus of most people is keep the money coming. So, in fact, there's a broad-based consensus to do whatever is necessary to get the money coming. And that's why it's so important that we all start decentralizing and in a way that reduces that risk, because literally the system can't take the risk.
Now, I was speaking with Russell Means, who was co-hosting our broadcast from St. Paul. He is one of the founders and leaders in the American Indian Movement, and he's also on a federally mandated police oversight committee regarding police violence in the state. And he said that the police in St. Paul for years now tend to be rather low-key and have a rather good relationship with the local citizens. Of course, you could find a lot of people who would disagree, but this is somebody who's been arrested 27 times and beaten most of those times. So that was his take, and he said that the feds, it was almost they had no choice but to jump in and hit hard.
Well, I have to tell you what you're looking at is the violence that occurs when a double bind frustrates people. And the reality is the people responsible for running this event are in a double bind. They've got a group of constituencies who want things that are mutually exclusive and are demanding that they produce all of them at the same time. And so what happens is you end up with these incredibly orchestrated events that can't tolerate anything other than a perfect production.
I can tell you, street level, it was a violent production.
Right.
And clearly it's going to leave blemishes all over St. Paul. Catherine, we're out of time, but we look forward to speaking with you again very soon. We appreciate the information, and we appreciate all the incredible work you've done. Thanks
okay,
for being
thanks,
with us.
Thanks, Dennis. Have a great day.
You too.
You're listening to POCC Black Report Radio with the Minister of Information, JR. Today we're going to be talking to Kilu Niasha, a veteran revolutionary journalist and activist in the community, and as well as a former broadcaster here at KPFA. We're going to be talking about what happened to Nadra Foster, a black woman programmer who was severely injured, hogtied, and brought up on charges of trespassing, among other things, in reference to a incident or an ordeal that she had with KPFA management and Pacifica management. Kilu, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And thanks for having me on, JR.
I definitely just would like to get your opinions, and I thought that the listeners can gain a lot from your opinions, having a history at KPFA, as well as knowing Nadra Foster, as well as having heard what had happened from Nadra Foster in discussions that you've had personally with her. Kilu, can you talk a little bit about how do you feel about the case of Nadra Foster? Can you update the people a little bit about what happened, as well as how did you feel when you heard about what happened to Nadra Foster, a black programmer at KPFA?
Well, I was extremely angry and very, very upset and incensed that such a thing could even happen at KPFA studios. And, that they would call the police in the first place is outrageous. And they should have learned from some of the experiences of the past. Because, as you recall, in 1999, Dennis was arrested and he wasn't brutalized, but he was, roughed up a bit. Earlier in the 90s, Akila, the woman Dredd, was arrested at KPFA, and I think she was roughed up. And this is uncalled for. There should be no reason whatsoever to call in this Gestapo, because that's the way they behave, to solve nonviolent problems, issues that happen, or contradictions, or personality clashes, or whatever happens in the studios with volunteers, paid and unpaid staff. should be settled diplomatically, certainly without resorting to calling the police.
Can you talk a little bit about your history at KPFA? What was the climate like for you as a black woman programmer?
Well, I started off working as with a disabled group that Philip Maldry had brought together in Youth News in Oakland, in downtown Oakland, because KPFA, up until about 1991, I believe, was the old building was completely inaccessible. I recall the first meeting I was carried up the steps to attend. I was very, very surprised that an all so-called alternative radio station that was supposed that bragged of being so non-racist and progressive. I only saw one black person there besides myself at that particular time, and it was Walter Turner. And I was shocked. I thought, "Wow, this is progressive."
Right.
So, and as time went on, we began. You know, in 1995. I became a part of, let me backpedal just a bit. I became a part of the Freedom is a Constant Struggle collective, I believe in 91 or 92. And the collective had already, Freedom had already been in existence at KPFA, cutting edge radical program with programs with radical programmers for some 26 or 7 years at that point. And we were so summarily dismissed that I couldn't believe it. It was just amazing that a collective of 5 people could just have, most of whom had worked there for a couple of decades or more, I was the newcomer, had the rug just pulled out from under us. So I left. I refused to, be disrespected. We weren't even formally told. I was fronted off as a representative of the unpaid staff at the meetings that led up to that, those cancellations and the installation of Jerry Brown with his BS, We the People, Our Daily program. At the same time, Ayanna Tinnen was banned, and she was doing the only one doing focusing on prisons besides myself and others. In Freedom, and then there was the women's department led by a black woman was canceled. The Third World Department was led by a black woman whose name escapes me right now, and that was canceled, and the women's department was canceled also, and that had a number of women of color in it. So they just cleaned house, and so the racism has been very apparent all through the years that I've been associated with KPFA. But I refused to apply for, at that time they were offering all of those whose program had been canceled, they were offering us 13-week programs to apply for. And I refused to apply for a program because, I'm not going to volunteer to be disrespected. That doesn't make sense. So I took Freedom as a Constant Struggle to the micro radio movement and Free Radio Berkeley, SF Liberation Radio.
I understand that you also wrote an open letter to the community in regards to this issue with KPFA. We have it posted at www.blockreportradio.com. What was in your open letter to the community?
Well, I was... that's kind of hard on the spot because it's pretty long, but I demanded reparations because it seems to me that if they are at all ashamed and embarrassed from what happened, and they should be, I'm a person who strongly believes if you've made a mistake, correct it. You know, don't deny it, and further exacerbate it, correct it. And so I insist on reparations. For Nadra, in the form of, I think KPFA should take care of her medical expenses. I think they should drop all charges, of course. They should cover her legal expenses. And I also think it feel very strongly, and you and I discussed this because this is really your idea, but I agree with it, that there should be a black public affairs program. on air, and there should have been one in place a long time ago. And some of us have, you know, have tried to get more black public affairs programming on the air with no success, as I mentioned earlier. But a black public affairs program that actually addresses all the issues that are affecting our black community, and we should also bear in mind that our black community consists of Haitian Africans, African Americans, indigenous Africans, Latino Africans, Caribbean Africans, and so on. We are not a monolithic group, and we are, and it's coming to light slowly but surely, that people of color are a majority, not only in this state, but in this country. And KPFA seems to want to continue to be a white supremacist or predominantly white organization in the face of this. And so getting back to the reparations, to repair the damage, we need to institute a black public affairs program that will cover incidents that are so common of police brutality in our local communities right here in Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco, and Richmond, because, J.R., we talked earlier, and you've told me that you lost 4 young black male friends just this summer, okay? And one of them was a volunteer programmer at KPFA. How is that not news? How come we didn't hear about his death on the KPFA news?
Still haven't heard about his death on KPFA, period.
I know. Now, this smacks seriously of racism, because it should be news. But the other thing is that I've learned that you can't make people care. You feel me? You cannot make people love people. But what you can demand is respect. And if we don't get respect, then we have to demand it. As Frederick Douglass once said, power concedes nothing without a demand. And the powers that be at Pacifica will concede nothing without a demand either.
Kilu, I understand that you had a number of discussions with Nadra since she was released from jail after being hogtied and carried to jail and brought up on 5 charges, originally 8 charges, including the ones that KPFA management and Pacifica management put on her. What did you and Nadra talk about? What did Nadra have to say?
Well, I called Nadra Friday morning to see if she had gotten out of jail. And she had gotten out at 2 a.m. Friday morning. And so she began, I, of course, asked lots of questions, and she began to describe exactly what happened. And at one point, I asked her if she had cussed the police out or, you know, had done anything to provoke them. And, you know, not being Kilu, she had not. I can't say I would have been as calm and patient, because I have a very volatile personality, but Nadra is a very calm, sweet, gentle person. And she doesn't cuss. And so there was really no excuse whatsoever for the behavior, the misbehavior, the maltreatment, the brutality that was so spontaneously, this spontaneous attack against her was just outrageous. It just made no sense. And at one point she said she tried to tell them, I'm a human being. And that just evoked more beating and more kicks. So the fact that the first thing she said was they body slammed her to the 2 police officers came in, and one of them body slammed her to the floor. And when she got back up, the other one started, as she said, practicing his karate on her. Then Anita Johnson, according to her, came in and tried to stop them, and they ran her out and called for backup. And the backup came in, and I think altogether there were 8 or 9 officers, all descending on this one small black woman, beating her. And at one point she yelled out, I'm pregnant. She found out later, she took a test and ascertained that she was not, but she at the time she wasn't too sure. And they were kneeing her in the groin and, you know, stomping her and just doing terrible things to her. I can't, I just, oh, I get angry all over again every time I think of it. And the fact that the rest of the people don't see anything, are not even alarmed about this, is really to their discredit.
Kilu, do you have any last words that you want the listeners to know to keep on their mind as they're coming across more and more coverage from the Black Report, from Flashpoints, and people like Apex Express and the apprenticeship program? Is there, and as well as Hard Knock Radio, is there anything else you would like us to know?
Yes. I think it's very, very important. I've seen, you know, we tend to describe people as white or black. And, you know, Vinny, as you put in your report, was the instigator of this mess. And he's a black man. I have learned, and we all should realize when we study just this one incident, that people misbehave or behaved badly who were black or white. We need to understand clearly, especially with the politics that are going on, the politicians that are being paraded before us now, we need to be clear that we should not judge a person by their book by its cover, a person by their appearance, but by their practice, by the way they respond and react, by the way they contribute, the way they serve the people, whether they love the people or they don't love the people. We cannot continue to ascribe to color a person's behavior. In other words, did the person do this because he's black, or did he do this because he's an idiot? Reactionaries and racists are rather readily identified by their practice. Brutality can and racism can come from any colored person. In other words, any person of any color can be prejudiced, bigoted, can be brutal, can be murderous, for that matter. Unless we want this to degenerate into some kind of a race war, we need to be clear, especially in this day and age, that we need to assess people by their politics and their behavior, by their practice, and not always describe them by color, because that's not always relevant. Am I making sense?
Yes. That was just the voice of Kilu Niasha, veteran journalist, right here on the Black Report, as she talked about the case of Nadra Foster, a black woman programmer here at KPFA, who had an incident, a run-in with the police that was initiated by the management of KPFA and Pacifica, which resulted in her being severely injured, as well as hogtied and taken to jail and brought up on originally 8 charges. This is the Minister of Information, JR, signing off for Black Report Radio. If you would like to get more information about the case of Nadra Foster and see Kilu's open letter to the community about KPFA, you can go to www.blackreportradio.com.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.